This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today is November 11th, Veterans Day in this country and Remembrance Day in other parts of the world. It's a time when we reflect on some of the landmark fights to preserve our liberty and way of life and on the people who did that fighting.
89-year-old Al Exner of Waukesha was literally there for some of those landmark fights. Exner was a combat medic, a corpsman in the Navy in World War II, and helped treat wounded soldiers at three of the war's turning points, the invasion of Normandy, and in the Pacific at the battles of Iwo Jima and Okinawa.
Exner's stories are among those from Wisconsin World War II veterans that were chronicled earlier this year by Howie Magner in Milwaukee Magazine. And so we're going to break format today and spend the whole show hearing from this remarkable participant in history.
Al Exner and Howie Magner joined us in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch. Always a pleasure.
Howie, before we get to Al's story, let me ask you maybe an obvious question, but why is it important to collect these stories so long after they happened?
Well, clearly it's one of the defining moments in our country's history and the world's history. And the way you remember those stories, the best way for my money, is to hear it directly from the people who experienced them. And the sad truth is that we are losing the people who saw these events firsthand. Of the 16 million Americans who served or wore a military uniform, less than 1 million are still alive today, and about 16,000 of those are Wisconsinites. And so the sad answer is time is running out to hear these stories firsthand from the people who lived them. And so with the 70-year anniversary being right now, we're basically in between VE Day and VJ Day, we thought it was an appropriate time to do the piece. I'm only disappointed and saddened that we couldn't do something earlier.
Al Exner, what was your role with the Navy during World War II?
I was a corpsman. But more specifically, I was on-the-job trained a surgical tech. My interest in medicine was that I went in after graduation at age 17.
And you grew up where?
In Racine, Wisconsin. And so I had my eye to go on to medical school, but of course the war interrupted that. So I was very, very gung-ho to learn as much as I could, and this is why I enlisted in the Navy Medical Corps. So they shortened everything up. They were in need of people. Obviously, we didn't know when the invasions were going to start, but even in that, back in those days, you could get a clue because everybody, the interview was so short. I got promoted before I left the interview, which was less than 5 minutes with this chief. And he's telling me I'm promoted because of my high school grades in science. And then he said, you're going to skip core school. And I was so naive. I said, what's core school? He says, that's where you learn to be a corpsman. I didn't know what he was talking about. After boot camp, they were assigning duty. There was 1 week outgoing unit for assignments, and they were assigning a lot of people to just work around the hospital grounds at Great Lakes. And I didn't want that. And the guys assigning the duty to first-class petty officers, I'm sure, looking back, that they thought I was a wise guy. And I said, I don't want that duty. I want to learn something. And then they smirked at, kind of giggled at each other as I look back. And they said, we have just the thing for you. And unbeknown to them, this was a good thing for me. They assigned me to the meningitis ward at Great Lakes. There were 20 young kids my age in a coma with spinal meningitis. Penicillin was just coming into vogue at 24 $1,000 for 100,000 units of the old potassium G. I didn't know first base. I didn't know how to take a temperature. It was, again, on-the-job training. There was a nurse there. I think her name was Kennedy, and I think her dad was a physician, and she took me under the wing. I didn't know anything about spinal taps, intrathecal injections, IMs, nothing. Well, in the 30 days I was there, she really taught me a whole lot, and I'm thankful to her for what she did, because it came in handy later on.
Well, and so how long was it before you were sent first to Europe and then to the South Pacific?
Well, actually, I spent most of my time overseas. Okay, boot camp was 9 weeks. Great Lakes Hospital was in the meningitis was 30 days. I was shipped to Europe on the old, very old cruise ship, Her Majesty's ship Aquitania, with 7,000 Army people. So it was, you know, we knew something was going to happen, and so they shipped us over there.
You want to talk about on-the-job training, being there treating the wounded from D-Day, that's some on-the-job training. And Mr. Exner, and he's going to get upset at me for calling him Mr. Exner. I feel like he wants me to call him Al. He always says
right.
that.
Please do.
Yes. But I can't imagine there are many people who experienced the battles that he did, because not only was he treating wounded from the Normandy invasion, but after that, he was shipped over to the Pacific and he treated wounded at Iwo Jima, and then he treated wounded at Okinawa. That's a heck of a trifecta of World War II combat to be involved in.
So I know at Iwo Jima, you treated the wounded on a ship floating offshore. Where were you stationed when the Normandy invasion happened, and how did you treat the wounded then?
We were in a facility a block off the water on Southampton Waters, and so it was just 20 miles from Calais in France.
Sure.
Actually, and so, I didn't know. I knew we were bombed a lot. I'd never gotten a bomb shelter because you couldn't leave a patient, of course. And when I heard that they needed more surgical techs because they only had six and they wanted more. And so I was, again, I was very, very lucky all through things. They took me on. And it, like I said, it was on-the-job training. And within 2 weeks, we were assisting. We were scrubbing in. And I just, because I was gung-ho to learn, I was just so interested in it. It really was good. I would take a call at 2 or 3 in the morning that somebody else didn't want to take, as an example.
Do you have any idea how many people you treated from the Normandy invasion?
Oh, yes. The service likes to keep tracks of things. I didn't know this later, but we were bombed 800 times with V1s, V2s, and planes. And yes, we did 68,000 procedures, and 10,000 of those were on German wounded. Yes. I guess we were averaging 500 a day, which leads me to tell you that after 3 days and three nights of no sleep, we went on more or less a 21-hour-a-day schedule. Our hands got so tender from scrubbing before surgery that we got smart and put on 2 pair of gloves at 6 in the morning. And then actually supplies were very limited. This place that we were, that was called a hospital, it was in its day in 1860. Queen Victoria built it for the troops from the Boer War.
I think there were still some leeches hanging around.
There was some not good equipment, and we were happy when the Navy got some. And we stayed up a long time to get it cleaned up and ready, but we didn't have any of the modern things that they have today with regard to instrumentation. But as an example, you know, again, I lucked out. One of my mentors there was Dr. George Novak from Harvard University. He was a neurosurgeon, and he was a very good surgeon, and he would not hesitate to stop a case and explain if you asked the question. These doctors they had never seen some of the injuries that they were going to take care of, actually. And I remember scrubbing in with Dr. Nova. I think it was a 4.5-hour job. Now, these things happened before the invasion. And this was a fellow that had been shot through the back. And other services seemed to send patients to us because they thought the Navy doctors were special, and I guess they were. And it was a brachial plexus exploration and repair, 4.5 hours, and he had a corpsman open up Gray's Anatomy and hold it for him because all the tissues that were laid open in the neck were very, very complex. But that was 4.5 hours of holding instruments, passing instruments, and so on and so forth. So
it must have been a really intense experience.
Yeah, all the way through. And like I say, they just threw us into it, and you better pick up on it because within 2 weeks we were assisting and, you know, and the first guy I got was a commander. He was a urologist, and everybody was afraid of him because he could kind of ligature with so fast you couldn't hardly see his hands move. You know? When you look back at this stuff, yeah.
We'll take a short break now and then return with more of our interview with Navy veteran Al Exner. That's in just a moment on Lake Fact from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We're talking this morning with Al Exner. He grew up in Racine and now lives in Waukesha. Exner is one of the subjects of a feature by Howie Magner in Milwaukee Magazine earlier this year about Wisconsinites who served during World War II. As we heard before the break, Exner served as a Navy corpsman and surgical tech. He was first assigned to a hospital in Southampton, England, across the English Channel from where the Normandy invasion was taking place.
Let's get back to that interview with Al Exner and Howie Magner now. Well, and so at what point did the service send you to the South Pacific?
Okay. I was there from January of 44 to end of September, roughly. Came home with 800 German prisoners. A lot of them were wounded. And by the way, they didn't mind being captured. Let me tell you, the wounded that were processed through there, they were actually most of them, I'd say 99.9 were very happy to be prisoners of war. We brought 800 of them back. Some of them were wounded. And that was our first exposure to some of their medical treatments, such as maggots, the creepy crawler things. We never had experienced that before.
The German medical treatment they were being
and they're very efficient, the maggots were, because they only ate necrotic tissue, of course, and then they would stop when they got to healthy tissue. So that was quite an experience. So we brought them back to Boston. They deloused them first with instead of us, then let them off the ship, and then there was a 25-day leave. And that's when I met my wife-to-be through a very fortunate telephone call. And
tell me about the telephone call.
Pardon?
What was the telephone call?
I didn't have room to get this story in the piece, and I'm glad that we're getting to it now.
I called one of my classmates because, you know, I'm 18 years old. And Gene Krupa was had a one-night stand at Memorial Hall in Racine.
You're going to have to tell people who Gene Krupa is, Al.
Yeah.
I know who Gene Krupa is.
You're too young for Gene Krupa.
I know who he is.
He was a drummer, and he was kind of a guy, because in grade school I was a drummer. And I thought he was, well, he was well known back in those days. So I called this classmate of mine at the nursing school. I knew she was in nurses training for the Navy. And so my aunt had worked for the DA. She was the DA's secretary in Racine, and she worked all day to get me two tickets. And by 4 that afternoon, she called me, and she was exhausted. And she said, don't even ask me how I got these tickets. So I immediately got on the phone, and I called for this gal. And my wife-to-be, Norma May, was her roommate. And she said, no, you can't talk to her. And I got a little upset. I said, what do you mean I can't talk to her? Well, she's got the duty tonight. They would split the shifts and take advantage, I think, of the student nurses. You know, you'd be off and then you'd go back on at 7 to 11 and stuff like that. And she said, no, she's not available. She's got to work till 11. And I thought, oh, gee, what am I going to do? And so I finally woke up to the fact that, well, I'm talking to somebody that's not working. I said, well, you're not working. How would you like to go to Gene Krupa tonight at Memorial Hall? And there was nothing, no answer for what I thought to be a long time. I said, are you still there? Yes. She said, I will go on one condition. And I would have promised anything, of course. And she said, I must make curfew because they're very strict. I don't want to get booted out of the Navy nurse program. So I said, I promise I will have you back in time to make curfew, and I'll pick you up and blah, blah, blah. Well, I had it then. We danced the night away, and I was in love right then and there, and that was 68 years ago. And I thought, boy, somebody was looking after me that she answered the telephone. We had about 2 or 3 dates after that, and I had to leave. Got shipped back to Boston, troop trained to the West Coast to pick up my ship. Now, this is where I start realizing the capabilities of the manufacturing that were supporting all of us in the military.
Right, there were a lot of people that didn't go overseas, but that played a huge role on the home front.
Well, they sure did. You know, the kids in my class, some of them were farm kids, and they weren't called up. You know, if you're 18 and didn't have an essential, so-called essential job, that you would get drafted. And so they were on the farm and supplying what the public needed. A lot of rationing going on, of course, but...
But these were seen as essential jobs.
Absolutely. And at the factory, the gals from my class, they were working in the factories. They were putting out stuff. And I don't think the public really realized the contributions that these folks made to the war effort. Without them, I don't think we would have been as successful. They were making more stuff than the enemy could destroy. As an example, Manitowoc, Wisconsin, they were making a submarine every month for 28 months. Now, that's a pretty complicated construction job, a submarine. And my ship, the Lubbock, was an attack amphibious transport. The keel was laid down like May 28th or something of 44, and I caught it in like the end of October. Now, that's only a few months, and it already completed the sea trials and ready to go. So it's just amazing as you mature and look back, and you can thank your lucky stars we had all those people contributing to what they did.
We'll have more of our interview with Al Exner after a break. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Life Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We're talking this morning with Al Exner. He's a Racine native who now lives in Waukesha. He was a surgical tech with the Navy during World War II, helping treat patients in the European theater during the D-Day invasion. His story is featured in an article by Howie Magner in Milwaukee Magazine back in July.
Exner went back to the U.S. on leave following his work at a hospital in England. When that leave was up, he was sent to the Pacific on the USS Lubbock, which wound up offshore at the Battle of Iwo Jima. Let's pick up the story with Al Exner's Pacific service and a caution that some of the injuries he describes are very graphic in nature.
So October of 44, you go on to the Lubbock, and it sets sail, and you end up in February of 45 at Iwo Jima.
Yep. Yes.
What do you remember from that time?
Well, we loaded up ammunition, the gunner's mates and that, at Long Beach, and then we took off for Hawaii. And what supplies we had, we left them there. And then at Hilo, Hawaii, we picked up some of the 28th Regiment of the 5th Marine Division. And there were about 600 of them for the planned invasion. We didn't know where, of course. They didn't know where. But on our way in the Pacific, you'd question these guys out on deck. You know, they're going through their calisthenics with what space there was. And I said, what kind of training you been doing? Well, they said, every day we charge up this volcano. In the big island of Hawaii. I said, a volcano? You're kidding. No, every day. That's what we do. Okay. Well, then when we got closer to Saipan, we realized they gave us the word. We had a practice landing there in very rough weather and a lot of – an LCVP is just a 5/8-inch plywood on a metal frame, you know.
And LCVP stands for Landing Craft Vehicle and Personnel, and these were the ships, the smaller ships that were used to take vehicles and personnel off of the larger ships.
And so they break up in rough water and stuff pretty easily. So we had our practice landing there, and then we headed for Iwo and arrived on site the night of the 18th. And the bombardment was going on. The big ships. We weren't that big actually, compared to aircraft carriers and battleships and cruisers who were shooting over the top of us. And it was like the 4th of July. These red projectiles going through the sky, hitting Iwo Jima and the bombers and that. And actually, before we got there, we had received maps, and it looked like there was a pothole in every inch of that island. And the scuttlebutt was that, this is going to be a 3-day invasion, and we're going to be in and out of there, and it's going to be a piece of cake. Well, it wasn't that, of course. The intelligence didn't know how dug in the Japanese were, so...
And you talked about being able to treat the wounded from a hospital, which might have been antiquated, but it was on dry land.
Yeah.
It wasn't moving. What was it like to treat wounded on something that's floating?
Well, again, it was pretty different. Actually, they couldn't get him off the beach. The LCVs were broached, which means they went in kind of sideways and got stuck. They couldn't pull themselves off. They couldn't with the winches and everything. They were stuck, and they were just sitting ducks for mortar fire and others. And the Japanese were dug in there. Iwo Jima was not that large a piece of real estate. It was 3 miles at the widest and 5 miles, 3x5. And it was a pork chop shaped island. And the 600 foot extinct volcano, Mount Suribachi, was right there on the end.
Well, so, and I gather you were actually within sight of Mount Suribachi for the flag raising?
We were, we were so close they were trying to sink us with or hit us with mortar fire, right? And that's when I learned that how ineffective was why the shells in that. You know, a battleship shoots a little over a ton shell, and an armor-piercing shell from a battleship will penetrate 31 feet of concrete. So it's pretty devastating. But of course, when, you know, they found out later all the slave laborers from Korea that were digging these tunnels and the caves were there, it was no reason. With the guys that were shooting at us, we could see them. We tried to get in as close as possible to give support and get the wounded off the beaches. And those guys were fired upon from a destroyer escort, and they disappeared, and we thought that danger is over with. 45 minutes later, they reappeared because they dug themselves out. The zigzag tunnels protected them.
Once they were able to get the wounded off the beaches back to your ship, you had to deal with something that most doctors and surgeons don't have to deal with, right. And that was the black sand complicating matters.
Well, that was, you know, a misnomer. It was not sand per se, but they call it the black sands. It's actually volcanic ash. And it's round. It's not irregular like sand and gravel. It will not pack down. And this impeded the Marines. And when it was wet, it was almost like quicksand. And, of course, with the LCVPs stranded, it was hard. So anybody that could get off the island with wounded would go to the nearest ship and more or less dump them, you know. And to get these wounded, this one devastating case was he came in, he was eviscerated. His intestines were out. He was hit with a 2.5-pound part of a shell. We didn't know that at the time, but we didn't know how this guy was alive. And we only had one operating room table. He was on it, and we just pumped him full of plasma and fluids and blood, whatever we had, for a whole day, and we lost him. It was his wounds were just full of volcanic ash. And when I talk about this guy, I really he died cursing the Japanese, you know, and I kind of said a silent prayer that the good Lord would forgive him because he didn't know what was going. And then I was honored to be in his burial detail. And this was in Navy tradition where the 5-inch shell, the biggest shell we had, was tied between his legs pointing upward, and he was sewn into a blue shroud, canvas blue shroud by the bosun's mates. So.
And buried at sea.
Yes. Another kid we got, I call him a kid. We were all about the same age at the time. He was a coxswain, and a mortar hit his LCVP steering apparatus and blew both his hands off. And we don't forget these things. I think of some of these guys every day of my life. What they went through and what they suffered. So it was a matter of, I didn't really get involved with patient care, but in between cases, if we had time, I looked in on these guys to see how they were doing, you know. So we had a bigger capacity to take more people, but we just couldn't get them. And we were there for over a week. We were there 9 days and nights until they ordered us away.
Al Exner of Waukesha served as a Navy corpsman during World War II. We'll return with more of the interview when Lake Feck returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Let's get back to our interview with Al Exner of Waukesha, a veteran of the Navy during World War II. He served as a surgical tech in England while the invasion of Normandy was going on, and on the USS Lubbock in the Battle of Iwo Jima and later Okinawa. We're also joined by Howie Magner, who wrote about Exner and other Wisconsin veterans in the July issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
You were just saying that you think about these people still today.
Yes.
You saw some really horrible things as you treated people. How do you think your war experiences have affected how you view the world since the war?
Well, like I said, I think of those, and I think any veteran that saw some of the bad stuff in the war, we really didn't talk about it to others. You're more apt to talk about some of the nicer things, if you can say that. But I don't know. We matured rapidly as 17, 18, 19-year-old. We took on responsibility. When I look back at my grandkids as an example, I think, my gosh, I was doing this stuff when I was 18 years old, 19 years old. But you were contributing. You were, you know, you felt part of an important situation, so to speak.
What strikes you, Mitch, after you speak with so many World War II veterans and veterans that I've spoken with for other stories, is the amazing things they were able to endure and accomplish at such a young age. And I speak about in the story about a group called the SAVE Team. They're out of Arrowhead High School now. A group of young kids who are interviewing World War II veterans and Holocaust survivors and getting their experiences on video as well. And the striking thing is these kids are doing this just a few years younger than the subjects that they're recording. And you marvel at how quickly these veterans had to grow up. It really is a mind-boggling concept.
Yeah, these kids have really done a good job, and they're taking their own time to do it too. I think they interviewed me at the library on a weekend, and Karen Ralke is one of the parents of these girls, and she's been a mover and a shover for the honor flight, and really has done a lot of good things and volunteered to bring this to the public's attention.
Now, you had a chance, I think it was in 2006, to go back to Iwo Jima. What was that experience like?
Well, and I can't tell you why I wanted to go back, but I nagged my wife for years, and I said, Norma, I don't know why I want to do this. And she finally says, okay, let's do it. So there's a group out of and they're still doing this, by the way. You can only go to Iwo Jima. President Johnson gave it back to the Japanese in 68 as a conciliatory type of thing. And this one-day visit that the Japanese can go there and we can go there is a commemorative service for the people that lost their lives there, the Japanese and the Americans. And the Marines from the Essex brought in vehicles for us. We flew from Guam. We left very early in the morning and flew up there on two chartered Continental Airways planes, and got there, went through their little customs thing. The Japanese had 2.5 airstrips. Airstrips there, yes. And now there's only one, the length of the island. So with these vehicles, we got there, and the Marines had put up tents for the Japanese and for us. And their hierarchy and their political people, they were there in their black suits and their white sashes and their military and so forth, as was ours. General Weber, the Marine commandant for the Far East was there, and Marine band and the Japanese military band, they played together like they'd been doing it forever, and various speakers, you know, and the Japanese, and everybody had a turn. We had General Snowden from a retired Marine Lieutenant General with us, and another one, Hayden from New York. And they were both Marine captains during the invasion, and they stayed in the Marines and got to be generals. But this is a very solemn ceremony, and I met General Kiribayashi, the commandant, whose body has never been found. He's probably in one of the caves that were blown shut, along with a lot of his people. And I met the grandson. He spoke in Japanese, and I went up to him afterwards and shook his hand, and I said, "You know, your grandfather was a very brave person." And he bowed and thanked me. And my wife said to me, "Why did you tell him that?" And I said, "Norma, he knew that they would never get off of there. This was part of their, you know, situation. Their philosophy was to die in battle, because if they were captured, they would be ostracized by the society, by the military, and by their families." And he truly was.
You're saying he was. He truly was brave.
When you look at the statistics, we lost, 7,000-8,000 dead and 17,000 wounded, and the Japanese lost a garrison. By the numbers, they lost their whole garrison of 22,000.
When you saw the island in 2006, and this is, 61 years after it happened.
It hasn't changed.
Did it all come back to you?
Oh, yeah. This never left me. It's not a nightmare, but it's a lot of thinking back every day. But it's still Iwo Jima in Japanese means sulfur island, and the sulfur fumes are still emanating out of there, so it stinks. It was a lousy place to be stationed for the Japanese. There was no fresh water. They only had rainwater. And, of course, we had a situation where they couldn't get any supplies in there either, you know. And the Korean laborers, they were indoctrinated that we were the bad people and so forth. And it's still a lousy place, none of our people are interned there. All the site where this ceremony goes on, all those people have been sent to other military cemeteries.
Are you glad you went back?
I am. Just kind of to almost think. Thanks that I never had to stay there, you know. And I feel I've been a very fortunate person all the way through, And in the article that's in the Milwaukee magazine, it said that the letters were chasing me in the Pacific. We didn't get mail much, but when we did, we got a lot of it. And I got 39 letters one time, and my wife-to-be, which I didn't know that was going to happen, she, out of those 39, I remember I got 29 from her. So, but you saw a lot of sad things. You saw kids that had broken heart syndrome, which is recognized today, that died because they got a Dear John letter that their girlfriend back home was found somebody else. And, you know, too many sad things to go along with the good things. But, you know, when I talk to different groups, you know, the Nazis were in German military was a lot different. They had a little respect, you know, more so. But the Japanese were a different philosophy. They, as I said before, they wanted to die for the emperor. And none of the ones that, the few that were captured, and probably the only reason they were captured was because they were knocked out by a bombardment and shell-shocked or something, they never wanted to be sent back to Japan. They wanted to get away from Japan as far as possible for that reason that they were ostracized if they, you know, the people looked down on them. And so they, most of them went to Africa and repatriated.
Are you still in touch with any of the people that you served with?
No, I'm not. And unfortunately, I don't ever recall that we had a reunion, which I was very disappointed in. You know, that after the war, there were a few of them. We got together. One was from Iowa and so forth. But yeah, that was one of my disappointments. Yeah.
We'll take one more break and then return with the conclusion of our interview with Al Exner. Exner served as a surgical technician in the Navy during World War II before returning home to life in southeastern Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Let's get back to our interview with World War II Navy veteran Al Exner of Waukesha. He treated wounded from D-Day, from Iwo Jima, and from Okinawa in his time in the service in 1944 and 45.
He's one of the World War II veterans featured in a piece by Howie Magner in Milwaukee Magazine over the summer. Howie wanted to know about how Al Exner viewed a more contemporary issue.
Al, you spoke about how World War II veterans in the past 10, 20 years are getting more and more comfortable with telling their stories. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is, and why do you think it's important that they've opened up about their experiences?
Well, I think it's very important. In fact, when I see somebody, I said, or if somebody says, oh, my grandfather never talks about it, or my uncle, or they never talk about it, I said, that's kind of sad. Is it? If he's still living, please question him. He did a lot of wonderful things and sacrificed a lot for all of us, and you should know what he did. And I urge other veterans, and I say, oh, well, they're not interested. I said, yes, they are, but if you don't tell them, and that's why I think this is so important. It's not an ego trip by any means. It's you know, a contribution. I like to think of what the veterans are doing and talking about this is a contribution to the people that are coming behind us, you know, that they know that what happens, the sacrifices that make us what we are today as a country, you know?
Sure.
Howie, do you think you're a different person for having done all of this? I mean, obviously, it's not the same thing to have been, you know, one of the people that served in World War II. But, you know, you went into this assignment, this idea. Do you think it changed you in any way?
Well, I grew up an Air Force brat. My dad was a 20-year veteran of the U.S. Air Force. And so I've always had that firsthand appreciation of the service that our military folks give to their country. But what I will say is it really opened your eyes. It you know, when you're my age and I'm in my mid-40s, World War II is something that belongs to history. You see it in books, and you see the stories about the battles and the world being saved. I think what you miss are the individual stories that all came together to make that happen. And you see a man like Al Exner, who was putting wounded back together, and you see a man like Ralph Windler, who's in the story, who fought his way through hedgerow country. You see a man like Jesse Ray, who didn't go overseas but served his country back here in the States by guarding ammunition dumps. All of these people, Doug Holt, who flew B-17s, Paul Bruno, who flew the C-47s that trained the glider pilots, you get an appreciation for this massive undertaking that helped do nothing less than save the world. But it doesn't happen without each individual person doing their job. And you really gain an appreciation for what those people had to go through. And again, at such a young age that, you know, kids ages 17, 18, 19 saved the world at a time when most kids these days are trying to decide what college they're going to go to or pick out their video game. And that's nothing against the kids of today. It just shows you, you know, how out of the norm it was to ask these kids to give up, you know, these years of childhood for the most part to go off and save the world. And it's amazing when you think about it in retrospect.
It is really – it strikes me as I listen to you, Al Exner, tell these stories that there are literally – millions of these stories out there. I mean, there were millions of people who fought this war, and each one of them has their own unique story to tell. This isn't really a question, but it strikes me that that we might have something to learn from each one that's still out there.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure. And as it was mentioned about these young people that are putting these stories out, that are recording this.
The SAVE team.
The SAVE team out there in Waukesha County. It's wonderful that they recognize. And it's interesting to see that these kids, a group I'm with is the 8th Air Force Historical Society. We're meeting with high school kids. And there are assignments, and these kids have done a really good job of grasping what the veterans have told them and put out a, you know. And we're going to still be meeting with more of them as time goes on, God willing. So anyway.
Well, Al Exner, it is really – it's an honor to have you here. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and for your service.
Well, thank you for the invite and also, your input, young man.
Thank you, too, Howie.
With the magazine from the Milwaukee Magazine, who has spent a lot of time going through a lot of stories. So that's a big contribution. To
oh, it was my honor, sir, and thank you for calling me a young man.
Well, by comparison, thank you both.
Likewise. Al Exner was a petty officer and surgical corpsman in the U.S. Navy during World War II. He now lives in Waukesha with his wife, Norma May, who he met while home on leave during the war and married in 1947. Howie Magner is managing editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His profiles of Wisconsin veterans of World War II appeared in the July issue.
And with thanks to all the veterans of World War II and other conflict, that wraps up our show for today. Tomorrow on the show, it's back to more local issues, namely the county budget. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Have a happy Veterans Day and join us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.